Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Devlin McCluskey, whose new project, Devlin and the Harm, has just released its self-titled debut record. Ending a decade-long absence from releasing music, the LP finds McCluskey writing about a number of deeply personal matters throughout a collection of songs that draw upon influences such as Fred Neil, Karen Dalton, and Damian Jurado. Produced by Alex Newport, known for his work with Death Cab for Cutie and Block Party, the album is an auspicious debut. McCluskey recently spoke about the source material for the songs and much more. That's Devlin McCluskey on Into Music, coming up now. You have a musical history, but now you're kind of starting over with this band and this album. What's that like when you have all that history and then it's like, okay, now we're gonna do something new?
It's a little terrifying. It's been 10 years since I've released anything, and I try to write just about every day, spend the first couple hours working on music. And so for me, there's something very freeing about the idea that no one is ever going to hear this, and you can explore and do whatever you want, and really making music for myself and for me to listen to when I go out on a walk every morning. And, you know, I love sharing with friends and I love playing with friends, but that has really been sort of my focus, is the songwriting and really trying to make stuff that I want to listen to and, hopefully developing as a songwriter. So to go from that to then putting music out into the world is, it's a little scary.
But at some point you made the decision, you said, okay, this is going to be a thing. What was that decision process like?
I really wanted to go back into a studio, and our goal initially was to try and beat the demos, essentially. And, I had started playing with a drummer, Mike Nussbaum, who I've been playing with for years, and he was in different bands that my old band used to play with. And then I had been in communication with Alex Newport. He was supposed to produce my last band, The Dead Ships. He was supposed to produce our new album, and we were working on that. Things sort of slowly fell apart with the band, but Alex and I had always kept in touch. I sent him a bunch of these demos that I'd been working on and really, really loved, and he was super into the stuff I was doing. So it was like, okay, well, let's go out to his studio, let's record a few songs, sort of test the waters and see if we can beat the demos. And of course, with Alex Newport, who is, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he's incredibly talented, has worked with a million bands and on a bunch of crazy good albums. So, yeah, I mean, he destroyed the demos, you know, it was great. And so then it sort of slowly became a thing of like, okay, well, I definitely want to come back and do more, go back out to a studio and record more songs. And then eventually it just got to the point where there were so many great contributions from all the collaborators who played on this album. And I felt like I owed it to everyone else to put these songs out, because people are working on it for little to no money, sometimes no money. And, at the very least, I want them to be able to go, hey, this is something that I worked on, check this out. And as sort of a way to honor the, you know, all the collaborators that worked on it, I had to release them eventually, you know. And then also, I just love the songs.
It sounds too like you kind of like the process of making something.
I mean, that's really what it's all about for me, is and whatever that is. I just love working on something that was not there before, figuring out all the little nuances and how to make moments pop more. And my day job as a video editor is very comparable to the timeline of video editing, is very similar to the timeline of a song, and you're playing with time and setting up expectations and either subverting them or delivering on them. And yeah, I definitely love making stuff. That's sort of what I wake up every day trying to do.
That's incredible. Now, I wanted to talk just a little bit about some of the songs on the album. And you opened this with Kingdom Comes, and I thought that was such a great kind of stark, in its own way, kind of unsettling opening to the album. Was that kind of always the front runner for that spot?
Yeah, I mean, that was my favorite song going into it, and really the thing that, I don't know, it was the song that made Alex Newport want to work on the album, and that felt like a big step forward in my songwriting. And yeah, it sort of became like a litmus test for me of like I would send five demos to some friends who I would hope would work on something. And it was like, if they thought Kingdom Comes was the song, then I'd be like, okay, you should work on this next project. And it really became kind of a like guiding light for what I wanted the rest of the album to be like. Okay, I love this song. What are songs that can live in the same world but go off in all the different directions that I like songs to do? But yeah, the song itself, I think, was different for me, where a lot of songs that I write, I think, are very like melody forward, and that's sort of the prime thing that gets me into doing it or gets me like really jazzed about the song. But with Kingdom Comes, it was much more sort of vibe and the delivery and this like smokiness to it, and just all of these sort of cinematic haunting qualities that were in songs that I was really into at the time, and trying to figure out, okay, well, like what's my version of that?
I would have to think too, for you, somebody who works in the visual world, when you're starting to flesh out a song, the possibilities that those cinematic qualities, that has to be really exciting too. It's like, oh, I could add this kind of like sort of counterpoint here, to this, or we can do this with production to make this stand out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to also like think of those things when I'm listening to music too. Like, when I'm hearing, like one of the big inspirations for Kingdom Comes was the Fred Neil song, The Dolphins, which I don't know how much of that is captured on the song, but that was certainly one of the inspirations for it, a big one. And I don't know. I mean, I've also seen that in a couple of movies and TV shows, but like when you hear it, it just, you get all of these visuals in your head of, like the guitar line does something, and you're picturing, different waves crashing, or mermaids swimming away, and just all of these fantastic things that audio can conjure up. Yeah, it's definitely the visuals and what kind of visuals a song or any audio inspires, I think, is definitely it's there when I'm listening to music, and I'm trying more and more to get it there when I'm writing songs.
When did you kind of like become aware of that kind of stuff? For me, it was the Peter Gabriel album So, and the song Red Rain, if you know that song, and that Daniel Lanois production. And just one day it was like, Oh, I get what he's doing. He's creating a picture with the sound, and there are these aural enhancements that are forwarding the lyric and the emotion of the song, you know? And I was like, oh my God.
No, I mean, this is going to be kind of a lamer answer, but I think A Day in the Life, the Beatles song. I mean, the symphonic qualities on there just sort of bowl you over in a way that like you can't only experience it auditorially. It is just a feast for all of the senses, and that immediately comes to mind. And then sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, I remember the White Stripes song Apple Blossom. For some reason, that like simple rhythmic, just like I remember listening to it and thinking like, oh my God, this just feels like the coolest opening to a movie that I've ever seen, and just like so dialed into the little simple rhythmic sound. But I mean, it's I don't know, it's hard to pinpoint an exact moment where I started hearing that in music, but I'm sure everyone does to some extent, especially as we become more obsessed with visual mediums.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, No Havana is a song that I understand has a lot of kind of this record, I think, as a whole has a lot of personal resonance for you, but that song I understand is pretty powerful from a personal standpoint and part about your father, right?
There were a lot of different sort of tragedies that went on as we were recording this album that ended up spreading out the recording process over several years. But yeah, my dad and his health declining, it shaped a lot of the feelings that went into the record. My dad was a writer and was working on a book about Hemingway for years and years, Hemingway and the Bulls. And he had always wanted to go to Havana, Cuba. He was a resident alien. And so he had always been a little nervous about, like, well, what's going to happen depending on what party was in power in the US? What's going to happen if I go to Cuba? Is this going to, in some way, jeopardize my resident alien status? There was a brief period where it seemed like we were going to be able to go, and we got him like an airline voucher. And so we had always hoped to go to Havana. And then in 2024, he had been diagnosed with kidney failure, was on dialysis, and I was back home in Illinois, sort of helping my mom and him out with various things around the house. And it just, I was faced with these two inevitabilities of like the country rolling back politically, and my dad sort of facing the end and realizing that like we are not going to make it to Havana, and sort of trying to figure out how to move on from there. And at least in hindsight, that's what the song is about. I feel like in the moment when the melody and the lyric popped up to me as I was playing, I don't know if I knew that that was, I didn't sit down thinking I'm going to write this song, but it sort of sprang up. And then, as I tend to do, as I'm sure many other people do, I just sort of kept playing the song over and over until that line, "No Havana comes to answer, better find a new dream," piecing together what the lyric means and what the song means to me, and then just playing it over and over till it makes some emotional sense.
Your dad didn't get to make it there. Does that give you some kind of resolve of like when the time is right for you, maybe you'll get there?
I'm definitely hoping to. We've been discussing going on our honeymoon. During the recording of this album, I also got engaged. That was very exciting. One of the nicer things that also happened during the recording of this album. And yeah, we've been discussing maybe going to Cuba for our honeymoon. Yeah.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, your dad being a writer, I'm guessing like when you start writing songs and kind of pursuing that, he got it.
Yes and no. I mean, I think to some extent, I mean, he was very, very supportive of any sort of creative endeavor that we would want to go on. And he's certainly like the biggest creative influence on my life. But I don't think stylistically he was very into the things that I was working on. He was much more a classical music and opera fan. And I think he was a bigger fan when I was playing the piano as a kid, learning, different sonatas and Beethoven and Bach pieces and all that. No, I mean he's always been very supportive. He came out to a number of Dead Ship shows, which we were a very loud sort of punky band and a very intense band, and it was great to see him out in the crowd as people are moshing and covering their ears. Yeah, I mean, supportive, but I don't know if I would necessarily classify him as a fan of the style.
Fadeaway to me is one of these, and just kind of talking about classical music, Fadeaway is like this shift to me in the album. And there's one other that I want to talk about in a moment. It's like we get the this kind of build up, and then there's like just this slight departure. When did you kind of know that that was going to happen?
I mean, that song I know we recorded, I think it was in our second session. The first session we did three songs. Second session we did three songs. And in the first session we did Kingdom Comes and Bad Actors and Stress Dreams. And they all had these very orchestral qualities. And then the second time we went out, I really wanted to explore some more groove stuff, and was really interested in that. Alex Newport got me really into Scott Walker, particularly the song "The Old Man Is Back Again," which we were I think trying to emulate a little bit with the bass line on Fadeaway. I mean, the conscious decision there, I think, was more wanting to again, going back to Kingdom Comes, like if Kingdom Comes is sort of what I think this album and this band can sound like at its freest, what does this band sound like when it sort of grooves? And to me, that's what that song and Dirt Used to Be Gold were kind of trying to do. And then Fade Away also has little nods to sort of tie it in with the rest of the album, with some of the sort of, for lack of a better term, like spaghetti western inspired guitar vibrato and things like that. Fade Away was also, I think, the first time that we've used a drum machine that's in there. And it's a very sort of acoustic driven song, but it has these subtle funk, and at the time we were like, oh yeah, let's throw on a little hip hop, let's get that old drum machine on there and see what that does.
Very cool, yeah. And then at Greenpoint Dryout, that also has this other kind of like, we're just in a little bit of a different territory, especially at the beginning.
I really wanted to figure out something more stripped back, and the I love an orchestral opening that doesn't necessarily belong in the song that doesn't necessarily feel like it. I think of like on Modest Mouse, Good News for People Who Like Bad News, the little orchestral things that they would throw in there, Neutral Milk Hotel, just these orchestral moments that help glue the album together. But if you were to release it as a single, it would basically make the song not be a single. I really I really wanted to sort of strip back on Greenpoint and I don't know, just like let the song be the song from there.
It's interesting because listening to it and now talking about it with you, you can it this is really an album in the kind of traditional historical sense, but I think you can also hear it as kind of one piece in a sense that these are movements within a single body of work.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, going back to that, like how did I bring myself to actually go from not wanting to release music, or recording this for myself to then putting it out into the world? I mean, as we were going through and recording these tracks, it became so clear to me that at some point we were thinking about releasing an EP. I do love EPs. I think they can be a great introduction to a band. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with them, but sort of the standard for the medium is the album. Like that is I didn't want to make a short film. I wanted to make a feature film. I wanted to put out a full album. And so it really became a process of figuring out which songs fit best together, because I do write and demo a lot of songs. I mean, it's been 10 years since I released something. There's probably 200 demos that we had to pull from of like, and then I wrote new songs once it became the identity of this album and the sound of this band became clear. Started writing songs to that.
I'll let you go here in a second, but I wanted to backtrack to something you mentioned earlier. And this is not looking for gossip or anything like that, but you kind of
No,
mentioned
no.
being in a band that kind of falls apart. And it sounds like, I think bands get to that point where it's like, are we all good? We all still want to do this thing. And some people just don't. And what's that kind of like when that happens? When it's like, I don't know, maybe it's like, oh yeah, I get it. I get why that person doesn't want to do this, or I thought we were in this, together. Are there a range of feelings like that?
Definitely a range of feelings. I think being in a band is really, really hard for a lot of reasons, but primarily just the lack of money in the music industry makes it very difficult to keep five people working on the same thing because there just isn't enough money there to support it and keep it going. And we achieved most of the things that we had hoped to do. I think when we first started playing together, it was like, we want to be the best band in LA, and we want to play Coachella, and we want to, play Summerfest in Milwaukee. And at least that was one of my personal things that I wanted to do. But like all of these things that, I mean, the best band in LA, how can you really measure that? But like the closest thing was LA Weekly naming us best band. That was cool. And then, getting to play Coachella was very validating. We got to work with so many amazing people too. I mean, we recorded an album with Brendan Canning from Broken Social Scene, and getting to work with him was so amazing. And learned so much from him. But yeah, as the years wear on, and you're You're still playing shows on some nights to very few people in the middle of nowhere. It just gets very disheartening very fast. And you, I don't know. I mean, you can't blame anyone for wanting to sort of move on and find something that can fully support them. And but I mean, it is really tough. I mean, I'm still very close with all the guys from the band, and it's been nice how supportive they are of this new project. But yeah, it's a lot of mixed feelings, where it's very sad to have a band sort of fade away. And I mean, we used to practice basically every weeknight for like 8 years, and then to go from doing that to just not seeing them anymore is also very, very strange. Yeah, it's really hard, but I think it's largely a symptom of just the lack of money in the music industry and the lack of support for young bands and developing bands. And it's really sad because I think this is, I don't know, this is just my personal feeling, but like when I go into a Walgreens, I the music that you hear in Walgreens is just going to keep getting worse and worse because it's going to be music that you've heard a million times. They're going to keep pulling from, the 70s and whatever, and then the new songs that they're playing are just going to keep getting worse and worse because we are not getting the sort of investment in the development of new songwriters, new bands. Yeah, it's very, very sad. And the thing that I always will point to is like when you're in a stadium and Seven Nation Army comes on, and it is just the greatest euphoric feeling of, thousands of people whoa-whoa-whoing together. That is the thing that we miss out on by not supporting developing artists because, if they didn't get a $2 million Michel Gondry video, I don't know if we know who the White Stripes are. And that is, I mean, incredibly talented. I'm sure that still probably would have broken through, but that's sort of the danger of what we can lose when we don't support developing artists.
You've been listening to a conversation with Devlin McCluskey of Devlin and the Harm. The new self-titled debut from Devlin and the Harm is out now and is available on streaming platforms and via Bandcamp. You can find out more about Devlin and the Harm at devlinandtheharm.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening, and as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.